Welcome back. This is Dr. K in for Mark Steiner. Well, we are in the midst of the 2016 Olympics, and black people are making and shattering records at an all-time high. From Simone Manuel, the first black person to get a medal in an individual swimming meet, to Usain Bolt, three gold medals in three Olympics for the 100-meter run. We have Michelle Carter, the first American woman, and of course that makes her the first African-American woman, to win the gold medal in the shot put. You have Daryl Homer, who was the first American, of course makes him the first African-American, to win a medal in saber fencing. This is the year of black folk magic that has also given rise to pushback, to criticism, to an intense laser-like focus on their lives. It's our second hour, and we're talking about race and resistance at the Olympics. Joining me to talk about this are Jerry Bembry, senior writer at ESPN's The Undefeated. Good morning, Jerry. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. We also have Stacia Brown, freelance writer. Good morning, Stacia.
Good morning.
Good. And we have the Reverend Merrick Moise, who's not a stranger to our show. He's an ordained minister, writer, community activist, teacher, and one of the first African-Americans ordained within the old Catholic movement in Baltimore. Good morning, Reverend Merrick. How are you?
Good morning. And you?
I'm doing well, sir. So, Jerry, can you give us an overview of what has taken place in Rio and why folks are so focused on how black athletes are dominating this year?
You know, we're in a situation now where African-Americans and blacks are dominating sports that they typically don't really dominate. And it's a surprise to some people. Now we see, Simone Biles has taken over the gymnastics game. A couple of years ago, we were in a situation where there were a couple of Italians said, we need to color our skin black because that'll give us a chance to win. And they were kind of negating her skills. But Simone Biles, over the last 3 years, has been the top gymnast in the world. This is not anything new with what she's doing in the Olympics right now. So you look at that sport, you look at judo, you look at fencing, the shot put, and now you're seeing blacks starting to dominate some non-traditional sports that we really don't really get into. And so it's a sight to see for African-American fans, but it's a shock to the system of some people who are not seeing blacks excel at those sports.
Now, Reverend Merrick, I wanted to ask you, because one of the pushbacks that we're getting, and we talked about that a little bit in our last hour, is that white America tends to love black athletes, either during the NBA, during the NFL, during their finals, and, of course, during the Olympics, literally wearing red, white, and blue flags right, and winning medals, but that doesn't play out on the street. So how do we reconcile these two?
I think it comes down to a question about, and this all goes all the way back to slavery, where we are useful, where we are in the service of or entertainment of white entities or institutions or people. But when we are just living life regularly as human beings, because we are not really seen as human beings in this culture, then we become a nuisance. Why aren't these Negroes doing something in service for us? That is how our relationship has been to this country. If we are not in some type of servitude or servile role here, then there is no use for us. And so, thusly, we deserve to be discarded.
Stacia, I want to talk a bit about Gabby Douglas. I actually want to start with her because we've seen the big campaign online, the love for Gabby Douglas that I think was started just a couple of days ago after she had all the pushback against her reaction, supposedly her reaction of not being very excited about Simone Biles or about Ali Raisman. Now, during this whole, the national anthem, the pushback is that Gabby Douglas did not put her hand over her heart, which we know you actually don't have to do. You can stand at attention. Is that similar to what happened in 1968 with the Olympics Black Power Salute, or are we reading too much into that?
I think that if she hasn't made an explicit statement about her intentions in not putting her hand over her heart, we shouldn't imply. And mm-hmm. She's since said that she's proud to represent the country and things like that. So I'm not sure that she was trying to make a political statement there. I think that it's logical for us to read into that, though, because of the fact that she is a black person in a sport that has not been kind to her. And it could be seen as an act of protest in some way. I just don't know that she intended it to be one.
I mean, Jerry, can we really believe that? I say that because we also saw in Tommy Smith's, he did made the Black Power statement at the Silent Gesture, his book. But he said it was not a Black Power salute. It was a human rights salute, but it has not been interpreted that way. So,
yeah,
so
do I don't think we I don't think we can equate what Gabby Douglas did to what John Carlos and Tommy Smith did. I was out in San Jose a couple of weeks ago and spoke to both of those guys during a ceremony. And those guys were making a huge statement about racism in America. And Gabby, I mean, if you look at some athletes on the Olympic stand, not everybody puts their hand over their heart. Some athletes laugh and joke during the ceremony.
As Michael Phelps did, right?
As Michael Phelps did, yeah. Exactly. So we really can't put a political statement on that. You know, Gabby just she just kept her hand down, and again, it's not a rule that you have to do that. And you know, a lot of people saying, well, you know, maybe Gabby's upset and she's not supporting her teammates, and there's some probably basis to that, because if you look at the opening days of the gymnastics competition, Gabby finished third among the Americans, and she actually finished third among everybody, and that should have qualified her to the all-around competition. But the Olympic rules are just the top two athletes qualify all for all-around. And so, yeah, Gabby Douglas in qualifying round was the third best of everybody, but she didn't qualify for that particular area of the competition. So she probably was a little upset, and maybe that's why she hasn't been as enthusiastic. But if you speak to her mates, they've had both said, Simone Biles and Raceman, that Gabby has been their biggest supporter throughout their competition in the all-around. And I just don't buy people criticizing her for every little thing.
Reverend Merrick, I mean, I don't want to be frivolous and stay and focus on Gabby, but we are speaking to the fact that Gabby's mother did release a statement that said, you know, they are attacking my daughter, they're bullying my daughter. And I don't know if you remember, but, you know, back when she was in London, all of the talk that came online about her hair, and it was coming from our community. We need to be real about that.
I'm not surprised, because many of us still have self-image issues. Mm-hmm. So we know that for many, the point of contention for many sisters, for many people, period, is a black woman's hair. So I'm not surprised. I wasn't surprised at London. I wasn't surprised at what happened here in Rio. But my question is, can we stay focused on this person's accomplishments? Mm. She has done an extraordinary job. And we also have to check in with ourselves in terms of the crabs in the barrel mentality, pulling those of us who do achieve down with these type of petty vitriolic comments, and we really need to check in with ourselves and how we look at ourselves. So if this, if Gabby wants to walk around with whatever's on her head, but she's clocking all these gold medals, then what is the beef? What's going on with us that we have a problem with this woman being a high achiever, but she doesn't meet the aesthetic standards that we think she should, based on, again, something that came from outside of who we originally are.
Now, let me ask you, Stacia, I want to talk about Michelle Carter in the shot put. First, she shattered her father's record that he held from the shot put. But one of the comments that she made, which I love, is she said that she was always told, you know, that she needed to lose weight, that she was this pushback when she was growing up. And her response is that what her mom said, you know, my body is built for something. So do you think this will kind of signify a new wave in the ways in which we accept the larger body, which is part of this whole politics around this notion of fat studies, which is a real area of research?
I certainly hope it does. One of the things that I love about Michelle Carter as well is that she is a spokeswoman not only for full-figured athletes, but also for beautification. Like, you know, so she's a makeup artist. She talks about looking her best and how that affects her performance. And that's not something that we typically talk about when we talk about female athletes, because we want to focus on athletics first. I don't think there's a wrong way to approach discussion of that. I don't think there's a wrong way to represent yourself in terms of appearance when you compete. But I do like the idea of her talking about how it makes her feel like she's doing better when she looks her best. You know, it helps her esteem, and her esteem affects her performance on that field. So that's an interesting take, and one that we don't often hear.
But Reverend Merrick, doesn't that get into what you were just saying about this image around self-esteem, around the way we look, that she's actually pushing back against that? Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it is a good thing, but I get concerned, because one of the things that we haven't taken into account in these things is that she's really still a young person. And how fair is it that this young person who has dedicated most of her childhood, her teen years, to achieving high success is pummeled with this petty vitriol? You know what I'm saying? I think that we forget, you know, that these people, and I was reading one of the articles, that these people are human beings. She's a human being. And then when we look at what has happened to Serena over the years, being pummeled from when she was a child with just racist and sexist stuff, we need to really examine how we are treating these athletes, and in the tradition of African-American athletes who excel far above their white peers, and yet still are met with all type of vitriol and hatred from their home. There's something amiss with that. When Michael Phelps can smoke pot on a video or picture, and then he's laughing at the national anthem and school faces his opponents, and yet not one eye is blinked.
Right.
We need to examine the level of bias that is going on here and decide that we're not going to put up with it, nor are we going to contribute to it.
Well, with this level of bias, and Jerry, I want to pull you back into the conversation since Merrick has brought into account Michael Phelps. If you could just talk a bit about Simone Manuel. I really don't want to discount exactly what happened when she won the gold medal in an individual swimming meet. Can you kind of help us frame that a little bit?
Yeah, I just want to go back to Michelle Carter for a second.
Okay, sure.
And no one expects a shot putter to be 110 pounds in a small person.
That just doesn't exist.
I don't even know why people criticize that. I mean, Michelle Carter looks exactly what I expect a shot putter to be. And I haven't seen the criticism on that yet, and I'm sure it exists. But any athlete who puts themselves on a pedestal, any athlete who excels, you know, whether it's Simone Biles, Simone Manuel, LeBron James, you're going to open yourself up to a certain level of criticism. And it's going to come from the white community who don't like black athletes excelling. And a lot of times it comes from the black community, like someone said earlier. So I just think it's really unfair. As far as Simone Manuel, I mean, a year ago or 2 years ago, there was a NCAA Olympic meet. And the three women in a 100-meter race were all African-Americans. It was the first time that they placed first, second, and third in a meet. And she was one of them. And that was a huge accomplishment at the time. So, yeah, there's on our website last week, we had a swim week because the perception is that black people cannot swim. But Simone Manuel is shattering all those perceptions. She's really excelling. She took a year off from her swim team at Stanford to focus on these Olympics, and she's come out and done a tremendous job.
Well, Jerry, let me ask you this, because you said, you know, the perception is that black people don't swim, but the research is kind of barring that out, that we do have, in terms of the black community, a number of people who drown. It's at a higher rate within the black community. I mean, I think part of that is steeped in some type of truth about the number of children when we start dealing with these stories of drowning in the water. Do you think that's just okay?
I think there's an issue in the community in terms of swimming. I personally can't swim. And, and there's some people in my office who cannot swim. So, but the whole perception is that none of the black people can swim. And now we had Cullen Jones, who's a male swimmer, who's on the last Olympic team of black African-American. And now we have Simone Manuel, the young lady, Neil, who won a medal last year in the Olympics.
Yes.
I mean, we have some athletes who maybe can encourage the young people in our community to go out there and say, you know what, let's go ahead and do this. We can accomplish this. We can excel at this. And let's go ahead and put our swim hats on and do this.
Reverend Merrick, let me have you come into this, because I know part of the story around Simone, which I think is very significant, is the ways in which black people were treated in the pool. Thinking about Dorothy Dandridge, she dipped her foot in the water and they drained the whole pool. So there's a lot of racism around black people in the water, which is more than just we're not being able to swim. It's not even being invited into these spaces.
Absolutely. When we saw a couple of years ago, some black teenagers had a pool party down in Texas, and just the madness that ensued and the rampant level of police brutality in that situation by one police officer, it was rather bizarre in his behavior. And we still haven't figured out what happened at the end, how he was disciplined for his just problematic behavior. But also, too, I want to remind us, and I'm not trying to keep going back to this, but during the period of enslavement, people were thrown overboard, and people were jumped overboard, and so we have a very interesting relationship with the water on this side of the Atlantic. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so the ancestral trauma that we often carry within us and acting out, we don't know why this is happening, is due to the fact that we have this relationship with the ocean and with the water. And I personally believe that in the 21st century, we can work to overcome that. I myself am trying to learn how to swim this summer. I can tread water, but I'm not doing laps. That being said, part of the reason why I want to learn how to swim is not just for fitness reasons, but to, just to give thanks to my ancestors that they are some of those who chose to survive, and yet I am working towards overcoming that type of ancestral trauma.
Stacia, I want to have you just chime in on this as well in terms of helping us to frame the significance of what Simone achieved. I know that, you know, years ago she has been winning, but just on that particular stage and how big this was.
I think it's really significant that she's using this moment to sort of comment on the historic segregation that's prevented generations of Black women and men from competing at this level of competition. And she's definitely, in every comment that she's given that I've seen about winning, she's talked about how she's doing it in part as an act of representation and resistance. And it's really important that she's doing that.
So now if we can talk about some other athletes. Jerry, I know that you may have to jump off soon, but I wanted you to chime in. I just heard on the radio this morning that Michael Phelps is worth about $55 million and Usain Bolt is worth $60 million. Can you talk about the phenom that is Usain Bolt? Because, you know, with all the other things we're talking about, perhaps we don't really get the significance of three gold medals in three consecutive Olympics in this one sport.
You know, he's been, since he's emerged on the scene, untouchable. We have never seen an athlete that big. Usain is about 6'6", who is that quick, covers so much ground, has a great personality. Everybody embraces him. I mean, he's one of the most world-renowned figures in professional sports. And the fact that he can make that much money from an Olympic career where, you know, it's really your shine is every 4 years, basically. You have the world championships every year, but your really big shine is every 4 years, speaks to how much of a great person he is. And, you know, he's a guy who says he's going to run his last Olympics this year, but I can see his success carrying on from here. Just such a great personality.
Reverend Merrick, I heard on yesterday that they're saying that he is the Muhammad Ali of running. Would you frame him in the exact same way? If you think about, of course, the legacy of Muhammad Ali coming through that time in American history to where he eventually ended up. I mean, would you agree with that?
I wouldn't agree with that in that respect. I'm not sure of Mr. Bolt's stand on social justice issues, but what I would give him is ambassador of the Caribbean, particularly of Jamaica, and Jamaican culture and Caribbean culture, which I think is equally important because it speaks to the diaspora, the African diaspora, and how wide and how deep it is. And I think that Usain Bolt is a great ambassador for that experience, but I wouldn't call him Muhammad Ali. I mean, I don't see him going to jail or sacrificing his medals for something that he believed in.
Yeah.
I might not know what sacrifices he has made, but clearly Muhammad was the greatest of all time, not just through his skill and his acumen, but through his lifelong dedication to serving his community.
But aren't we seeing this now, Stacia? I mean, there's a whole story about how athletes are starting to stand up. I mean, you think about what happened at the ESPYs. You think about Michael Jordan finally joining the struggle that is Black America. Are we seeing this push towards having athletes be more aware, being more woke, is that sense that they're talking about?
I think that we're seeing more athletes talking about their positions, their political positions publicly, and that's really important, and I'm glad that they're doing that. That typically used to happen in the 70s and stuff. It fell off, I think, in the 80s and somewhat in the 90s, and it's coming back around as something public now.
So, Jerry, with that, you brought up Simone Biles. I wanted you to come back to her, you know, with that statement she made, which I absolutely love. I'm not the next Usain Bolt or Michael Phelps. I'm the first Simone Biles. What is this in terms of helping young Black female athletes, or just young Black girls as a whole, kind of begin to see themselves as the first? Is that the positioning we're talking about, or just in this narrow sense of responding to the push of her being the second Usain or the second Michael Phelps? Is it bigger than that?
You know, she wants to be the first Simone Biles, and she's a very unique individual and has a unique background, you know, following in a path of a Dominique Dawes and a Gabby Douglas. But, you know, she is considered to be the best gymnast of her era, perhaps the best gymnast of all time.
Wow.
She doesn't have to be grouped in with anybody else. She's a very unique person. She's got a long career ahead of her. You know, I can't wait to see her at the next Olympic Games. And she's going to cash in just like Phelps and just like Usain Bolt.
Well, let's talk about Daryl Homer. Daryl Homer, Reverend Merrick, he is African-American male, of course, but he made a historic win for Team USA. He was awarded the silver medal in men's saber fencing. He was the first American, of course, by default, the first African-American to take home the award in 112 years.
that's an amazing accomplishment. I did a semester of fencing in high school, and I'm going to tell you, fencing is hard, and it can be dangerous. And so for this brother to have the opportunity to do that is amazing. And also, too, I think we want to keep in mind how expensive some of these sports are.
Yeah. Oh, that was my next question. Yes.
Yeah, because when I grew up in New York and I was going to high school in Queens, and in order for me to get advanced level skill, I had coaches saying, oh, yeah, you're great. You know, you should go down to Manhattan and go to the fencing club. Well, I'm a black Catholic kid from Queens. I'm not sure about taking the train all the way into Manhattan, into a part of town that I know where nobody looks like me, and actually fencing and having to bring equipment onto the train and all of that type of stuff. So the fact that he was able to do that and surmount whatever hurdles were in his way is so admirable. And that's something that our kids can look at and be like, you know what? Where there's a will, there's a way. And maybe some of us will now start our own fencing club. I'd love to see a black fencing club in Baltimore. That would be dope.
And they, actually, there is. I mean, the Chesapeake Fencing Club is right here in Baltimore City. I say that because my son's a fencer. I mean, he fenced with the Chesapeake Fencing Club. And you are right. It is expensive. I was talking to him. I said, look at Daryl Homer. Let's go back to fencing because there's got to be a white head in the next Olympics. Like, we need to be Tokyo back. Like, we got to be ready. With that, Jerry, since we're talking about Daryl Homer and fencing, I wanted to bring in Miss Muhammad. I cannot pronounce her first name, and I don't want to mispronounce it, but she's a black female fencer. Of course, she fenced in her hijab. She's the first one to ever do that, and she won the bronze in saber fencing. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of that?
Yeah, I think it's an impact for her people and the fact that you can compete in looking in a non-traditional way. And again, I mentioned this earlier, now we're seeing different shades of colors and nationalities come out and shine in the art of fencing. So I think it just really opens up. And, I mean, that's the great thing about the Olympics. Every 4 years, you see some really fantastic stories. You see the fencers. You see Rafaela Silva from Brazil winning a medal. There's just some really tremendous stories of people with some great accomplishments. And this is why this is one of the best events in the world every 4 years.
I mean, it's wonderful to see the number of black bodies, right, being celebrated, being recognized, being loved. I mean, the tears that flow from what it means to be American, for some people, it takes away from the attention about what is still happening in Milwaukee, right? What's happening with the FOP here in Baltimore City. And we're going to talk about that because we have to take a brief break now. But don't go away. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Olympics, about race. We'll talk about Carmelo Anthony. We'll talk about what is going on and how we can extend that love from Rio back here to the United States. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Dr. K in for Mark Steiner. And welcome back to our conversation about the Olympics and what I'm calling black folk magic. We want to thank Jerry Bimbry, who had to jump off the phone. We still have Stacia Brown. She's a freelance writer. And the Reverend Merrick Moise, who's an ordained minister, writer, community activist, teacher, and one of the first African-Americans ordained within the old Catholic movement in Baltimore. We broke off talking about the impact of black people in fencing, an area that you rarely have seen at this point, black people competing on that level, and what that means to have the world see this. Reverend Merrick, if you could, can you frame us for this internationally, for the world to see black people in sports they've never seen, outside of track and field, outside of basketball, but in some of these other areas like shot put, like fencing?
I think there's an inspirational quality to it. As someone who's watched the games for many years, and being able to see people that look like you, that look like people in your family compete in these clandestine sports that you'll never see, like where you are because of whatever circumstance, is so incredibly invaluable. So even if, you know, young Tammy doesn't take up the shot put, that may inspire her to do something totally out of her cultural norm that will enhance not only her life, but the lives of those around her. And I think that's what the value of it is. Conversely, I know that there are some people in our community that say, well, this is taking away from the real problem.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we We need all sides and all facets of our life. The lives of Black people in America is not just a life of suffering and servitude.
Yes.
We also have lives of great achievement and triumph. And I think we do need a balance in how we see ourselves. And focusing on these athletes in a time of dire straits just as this provides a certain sort of psychic relief for us. And I'm in support of that.
No, I'm saying it really becomes this issue around self-care. I mean, because of all you're talking about, what I found is just the death of Black people, and I'm talking about, you know, the actual killing of Black bodies over and over and over again, it gets disheartening. Like, it gets hard. And the Olympics, I know, celebrating from Simone Biles to Michelle Carter, which really inspires me, from, you know, Daryl Homer to even Carmelo Anthony, who this week, Stacia, broke a big record. I mean, he became America's all-time leading scorer in basketball. Mm-hmm. But Carmelo also, if I'm not mistaken, uses his voice. And he does take this platform. So for athletes like Carmelo, I mean, we're just hearing the name Michelle Carter, right? If you don't follow gymnastics, you're just hearing Simone Biles. You really haven't even heard Daryl Homer. I don't know how that's going to transfer for him. But you know Carmelo Anthony. I mean, does he have a greater responsibility to continue to use his voice and use the Olympic platform to speak about these issues in even more detail than some of the other more lesser known athletes should do?
I think that he always uses his platform to speak about these issues, and it's really important. I don't know that he has a greater responsibility to do so as long as he continues to do it and that the other people see that as an example and join him. I think that would be a wonderful thing.
Now, Reverend Merrick, I'm thinking when I look at Carmelo Anthony and breaking this record, I think about Michael Jordan, who I jokingly said earlier that he just kind of recently joined us, right? but that he did not and has not previously used his platform. Do you think these athletes, and again, I am talking about the Carmelo Anthonys, I'm talking about the Michael Jordans, I'm talking about athletes who have a career that in so many ways, Reverend Merrick, bigger than the Olympics, right? We start talking about, you know, the NBA rings and the NFL rings. Don't you think they have a greater responsibility, or am I wrong on this?
I think they do have a responsibility, but I'm wondering what that looks like, right? Mm. So everybody can't be a human rights leader.
Right.
So I would like to see some of these athletes build schools. Some of these athletes invest in our HBCUs. Some of these athletes actually build homes. And some of them do that, and they do it very quietly. I think we need to amplify that. Also in terms of the social justice. It's one thing to talk about social justice, but what we need to do is continue to build Black institutions on the ground. And I would like to see more of those athletes do that, because that in itself is a form of Black nation building, right? So for me, it's not either or, it's how can I get in? How can I augment the fight? How can I, you know, engage in the struggle? You know, and I need some of these brothers and sisters who's doing this work quietly to, like, let's shout it out now. Because oftentimes on social media, you see, well, they haven't done anything and all of that. But we don't know what people have done unless they told us. And I think Carmelo is an excellent example of someone who walks the walk and talks the talk. We know he's from Baltimore. He has a very interesting heritage in that he is Afro-Latino. And so he's giving visibility also to a part of the diaspora that oftentimes in America we don't talk enough about.
Now, I just got a tweet where someone's blasting me for letting some athletes off the hook. And I want to be clear that if the Olympics is kind of your first foray into this international field, I'm thinking about, you know, Simone Manuel's life after this, right? You think about what Daryl Homer's life's going to look after this, what Michelle Carter's life is going to be after this. I'm talking about athletes that with or without the Olympics, they had a major career. They had a major income coming in. So I'm not letting people off the hook. I'm saying if you were already Michael Jordan, if you were already Carmelo Anthony, if you were already that person, then the Olympics does not help to propel you any higher. It just keeps you on that same level of being consistent and delivering on any type of platform. So it's not letting them off the hook. It's just adding to that. We want to get to some of the phone calls. Cecil, you've been waiting for a while. Cecil, welcome to the call. Cecil, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Yes, hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah. Good morning to your panel.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I would like to make a couple statements. First of all, concerning this win, back in the 70s, it was a Philadelphia recreation director, Black, And he took a group of teenagers. Actually, it was a movie made about it also. And he came. It was a regional championship. He built them from nothing, and they ended up winning the regional championship. And ironically, came to I believe it was Catonsville Community College. The championship was supposed to have been here in Baltimore. I mean, up in Philadelphia, and the white racist groups. Well, I shouldn't call them groups, but the swimming club didn't want to come to the Philadelphia venue because they thought it was beneath them and it wasn't up to standard. So
okay.
The Philadelphia team came down to, like I said, I believe it was Kingsville Community College.
Okay, and this is in 1970.
The championship was there.
Okay.
And they ended up winning the regional championship. And it was a movie made about it.
Okay.
And, I was just saying that, you know, a lot of us, a lot of black people are gifted, not only athletically, but with their minds also. And I think we just need to get away from, we need to read more and know more about history and stop letting white people tell us what our own history is. We need to know it and be able to quote it ourselves.
Okay.
And to also segue off of what they were just saying, I definitely agree to make a point. Why can't we all, instead of not only the black athletes, funding, maybe because maybe just the general public. You got to remember, if just however many black people there are in the United States, if everybody just gave, grown people gave maybe $5 and donated, we could build our own recreation centers. We wouldn't have to depend on the establishment to give us something. Let's do it ourselves.
Okay, thank you so much. Reverend Merrick, I want you to comment on that last piece, because I believe that's an issue that we're fighting about here in Baltimore now, right? The lack of community centers for young inner city boys and girls, that for them to study these sports, where are they going to do it if there's no place to do it?
See, and that's the problem, right? Because you do have these sports. Again, we talked about the cost associated with some of these sports and literally the space that you have to have
right. To
actually practice this stuff. So I think that one of the things that we might want to think about is pooling our resources so that we can create community centers for ourselves that can encourage kids to practice some of these sports, but not just sports, just a wraparound services, right? Because some of the most talented people that we have in our community live in the most dire of circumstances. So it's not just putting a ball in a kid's hand or throwing a girl in a boxing ring or putting up a hoop somewhere. This is about comprehensively taking care of our folks so that sports and life and all of those things can work in tandem for their own good. And I would be interested in how we can pool our resources to take care of our people in that way.
I mean, I like that as a question. Stacia, I want to ask you, because Merrick kind of alluded to it, putting a girl in a boxing ring. I think about, you know, Rafael Silva, which is the black woman who won the gold medal for judo, that you have black women also in these other sports that go against this notion of what it means and the ways in which we frame being a female in this country, which I think is pretty powerful to push back against this notion of what it means to be a female in these sports that are dominated heavily by the ways in which you move your body and how strong you are, like with the shot put. So how do we help reframe this conversation for young girls?
I think the women that are participating are doing that just by being there with mm-hmm. their presence and with their excellence. They're doing that. And I also think it's important, going back to what Reverend Merrick was saying about the wraparound services and how important they are. It's a lot of elite athletes, particularly in America, only have to worry about excelling at a sport. They don't have to worry about all the other things that we do have to worry about in our communities a lot of the time. And being female is one of those things that is a risk for a lot of women in urban communities, in low-income communities, and it's something that doesn't necessarily get protected or talked about in athletic spaces because people aren't thinking about it in elite spaces. It's something that counseling would help, is something that mentors could help, and a lot of those things are important and not necessarily hitting people where they should, I guess, like in yeah, so that's
well, literally and metaphorically,
yeah.
Right,
because yeah.
I think about boxing. I want to get to some more phone calls. I may mispronounce your name. It looks like it's Mutilette, is that correct? Welcome to the call.
Mutilette.
Good morning, how are you?
Good morning, pretty good. A lot of stuff that in the school they're not teaching anyway.
Okay.
First of all, the first car was invented by a black man. Okay. It was called the Patterson car. Okay. Mm-hmm. The term black and white didn't come until the 1600s. Okay. We dominate everything. But what it is that NBC, CBS, ABC, and all that, they because the Europeans are running the network, and they always bastardize, they always say negative stuff about us. But we're the inventors of everything. And that's why the slaves, that's when they got the slaves, et cetera. But the issue is that a lot of blacks, well, they don't go and research. Once upon a time, they didn't want to read, talking about slavery. But now you got a chance to read. You want to be know who you are, the kings and queens. We don't want the G is the gold, the O is the O, and the D is the diamonds. You know where it come from. I'm not an African-American, I'm African. Okay, but if you don't know who you are, then you'll go for anything, but take the mirror from you, actually think that you're white. We dominate everything.
I definitely agree with that. Well, I mean, in terms of Reverend Merrick, I want to bring you back in and comment on what Mudalette is saying. I want to focus on one particular piece, this notion of us not knowing our history, not really understanding what black people have contributed to this country. How do we help young people to kind of get to this understanding? I mean, I know we want to do it in schools, but if it's not taught in schools, what should people do?
We should teach it in our homes. And if we don't know it, then we as an adult don't know it, then we need to read and learn and watch. I think one of the things that we've gotten away from is intergenerational conversation. And sometimes just sitting down with auntie or uncle or grandma and grandpa or the neighbor that has been around forever and hearing our local history. One of the things that blesses my life the most is I have a Buddhist mentor named Charlene Gaskins, and she is from Baltimore, and her family has deep roots here. And just listening to her talk about the past, listening to her mother talk about the past here in Baltimore, gave me a sense of the beauty of our community down through to this present moment. And I think it's more than just reading books about Harriet Tubman and Malcolm X. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
I think
right,
part
right.
of this is that we really need to talk to our seniors, our elders among us, and really get an idea of what black life was like back in the day and the dignity in which people carried themselves. I don't have to read a book about Harriet Tubman, but talk to my neighbor and understand how black people own their own businesses during the dark hours of segregation and what the resilience that it took to live in a place where you could go to the Eastern Shore and be lynched. And what if you had family on the Eastern Shore and what that looked like? What did it look like when UB Blake and his jazz caravan came through Baltimore with Billie Holiday and the pride that people felt in themselves, particularly in the Baltimore context? I think that's what's important. Can we just start talking to one another?
Right, I completely agree with that. Stacia, I want to have you add in on this because I want to talk a little bit about what they call the black girl magic. And we know this is a term that came up through Twitter. It moved from Twitter to being kind of a rallying call. It moved to T-shirts. But there's a whole article in The Root about Olympic athletes embracing their black girl magic in Rio. And they highlight, which I think is wonderful, Ashley Johnson. And Ashley Johnson is from Princeton, and she's a water polo player. She's the guard. And so the pictures of her, if you were to go online and just Google Ashley Johnson, of her at the goal in this pool full of white people at that point, and she's the one blocking the ball. She's very tall and very graceful. So exactly what is black girl magic, and do you think it's being embraced in Rio, or is it just another way to kind of tie social media to this whole thing?
I think it's being embraced by spectators, certainly. I always credit Kashawn Thompson with coining that term. She's a black motherhood activist, and she started that in part as a self-esteem building thing on Twitter, and it's a really, it's become, I think it's exceeded everyone's expectations in terms of how it's made its way into the zeitgeist right now. I don't know how people are embracing it in Rio, but certainly the fans here back home are very, very into it, and black women are dominating almost all the sports there that they're competing in, and it's just amazing this year.
I mean, it is amazing to see the black women. I'm definitely looking for, I think about Aja Wilson, and she's a runner. I mean, I know I her name came to my attention because back in 2014 when she was running at the USATF Outdoor Championship, she was 8 months pregnant, and she got on the line to run, which was just such a display of the strength of womanhood. I could not even imagine at 8 months pregnant, barely being able to see my feet, nonetheless, you know, lining up to run a race. So Black girls are dominating in all the areas in which they're competing. But Reverend Merrick, there are areas where it still seems like Black folks are not able to get in. I think about equestrian. I don't see any Black athletes there. I'm looking at trampoline. I'm looking at tabletop tennis. I'm looking at rowing. I mean, I'm wondering if part of the reason, particularly for the rowing and for the equestrian, is about that point you were making about these very expensive sports to put our kids in. I mean, equestrian just seems to be very expensive.
Absolutely, and the type of training that you need to be that level of ridership, I'm not sure we have places in Baltimore City, in particular, or urban centers across the nation that foster that level of expertise. So that may require people going outside again. And also, too, we have to realize that a lot of these people who are in these so-called elite sports, they're country club kids. Okay,
yeah,
so
let's be
they
real.
Have a long, yeah, there are in a long line of people who go to the country club and ride, and I went to Oxford, and so I was on the rowing team. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we don't even want to get in the harbor, let's be real. But I think that one of the things that we can do is that we can create situations where we get our kids to these places and encourage them to take these sports. Because if the Jamaicans can come up with a bobsled team.
I love that. Remember that? That was amazing.
Yes.
I mean, and they lost, but it was great.
It was great. And it was their will to represent their country in this space where usually Black countries are not represented at the Winter Olympics, right? Because usually we live, at the equator or in tropical areas, right? The most of us do. So I think that where there's a will, there's a way, and that we can, you know, does that mean that some of the wealthier Black folks need to, like, create scholarships in the Tony schools that they went to so that people can, you know, engage in these activities? I think we need to start thinking about that.
Now, I think that's an amazing point that you just made. I mean, because you brought into account the Winter Olympics. I want to just know that when you look at the number of Black people who are in the Summer Olympics versus the Winter Olympics, I mean, if you're thinking about bobsledding, if you're thinking about, you know, the skiing, if you're thinking about curling, like you're talking a ton of sports where you will not see the number of Black bodies that you've seen this summer. I mean, this summer, of course, was groundbreaking. How do we get that translated to some of the other areas, Stacia? Like, what else can we do? Merrick has raised a couple of solutions. What do you think?
For Winter Olympics specifically, I'm not really sure. It really depends on, I guess, regionally, how many Black people are involved in competition in places that are cold weather places. And I'm not sure that there are as many of us in some of those super snowy places. There, you know, so it, yeah, and I don't know that the desire is there for winter sports, too, because it's underwatched, it's underattended, I think, sometimes, winter sports. And summer is, like, the more popular spectator competition.
I also wonder, in terms of the ways in which you have access to this, Reverend Merrick. I know that my sons were, I mean, one son kind of mentioned hockey to me, and I was like, okay, you know what, that sounds cool. How about baseball? Like, I'm trying to stir them towards something that, for me, is a little bit warmer, but to me also seems more accessible. I mean,
yeah, and you know what's so interesting about that? In growing up in Queens, we had lots of baseball fields, right? And then, and so it's also about access to land and creating those spaces, right? And a lot of us just somehow got funneled into basketball when actually, if we think about it, it was the Black baseball player Jackie Robinson that broke the color barrier in major league sports, regardless of the sport, right? So some of the things that we need to look at is creating spaces where kids can practice some of these sports, because they do require a large amount of space. And so it's not just about going to the batting cage, right? It's also about learning how to field, learning how to catch the ball in the outfield, and those skills that are required for high levels of professional play. And if we could do it back in the 50s and 60s, we can do it now. It's all about our will. And, you know, hey, if some people are going to, you know, pay $600 million for boat flips on Park Covington, can we get a baseball park in Park Heights? Now, can you, we do that?
No, I'm completely agreeing with you. If you just joined us, this is WEAA 88.9 FM. This is the Mark Steiner Show. I'm Dr. K. And we're talking about race and resistance and black folk magic at Rio. We just got a tweet in from Sasha Notes. She's saying, you know, just check out online. You could even get the Black Girl Magic T-shirts and support that notion of what does it mean. We have a phone call here with Henry from Northeast Baltimore. Henry, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, you guys. I just want to be on the lookout for Clarissa Shields. She's a boxer.
Okay. Yes. And she's from Detroit. Is that her?
Detroit. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And I think she was the only one who won a medal in the 2012 Olympics.
And she was actually the youngest boxer ever, if I'm not mistaken, youngest female boxer to win a medal coming out of Detroit. Yes, her story, you can see that online. It is amazing.
But back in 2012, she didn't get too much publicity afterwards.
Right.
Because they were highlighting the pretty girl. She's like a Hispanic girl.
Yes.
And she was supposed to be the successful one to come out of the 2012. But Clarissa Shields, she went there and did what she was supposed to do, and now she's back. Hopefully she'll, have more success again this year.
Thank you so much. Now, Reverend Merrick, he just raised a very good point. I mean, if you look at Clarissa Shields, and he was saying that perhaps she didn't get the attention in 2012 because of what she looked like. You know, they went after the one that was, what they call prettier. And I really have a problem with these terms, right? Because we know that, the notion of being pretty versus not being pretty, all these are terms that are set up within this particular system that is designed to keep certain types of people out of it, right? If you have darker skin, thicker hair, and so on. But don't you think that's different this year, that due to social media, you don't have to wait for ESPN or you don't have to wait for NBC to say you're the golden person? Can't that happen through social media?
It can. It definitely can happen through social media, and I think that we should encourage that, right? So it's not just about what NBC is covering on stations, mainline stations. It's about what we focus on, and I think that we should definitely highlight some of the most remarkable achievements, not only in this Olympics, but throughout our community in regard to sports, particularly people who are doing unusual things, like the black chess masters or something. Because I'm very interested in the images that we see and that we share that are outside the narrative of black pathology. And I think that only we can correct that, and we have a great tool in social media to do that.
Well, I don't want to, as we go through, I do have to talk about Venus Williams. Her sister wasn't able to advance with her because Serena lost early on. But Venus Williams, although she missed out on becoming the first tennis player to win 5 Olympic gold medals, which I have a problem with that whole headline, she is the first tennis player to win 5 Olympic medals. When she and her partner, she made this very interesting comment with Rajiv Ram. She said, when I'm with my sister, I know we're going to win. I wasn't that sure playing with someone I've never played with before. How are we not, as a country, focusing on what Venus is doing? Like, it seems to be really downplayed. Is it because she's been around for so long? Is it because it's tennis? I mean, what do you think, Reverend Merrick?
I think it's a combination of things. I think that for some, she's the other sister, right? So the other sister kind of gets played to the back. And I also think, too, the same old racist stuff that they've been facing since they came out of Congress.
Yes.
You know, and I think it's unfortunate because, truthfully, if it wasn't for Venus and Serena, would we even be still talking about tennis like we are now? And I think that we really need to look at the optics on this. Both of those women are phenomenal in nature. No one has ever seen a pair of sisters like that in the modern era of tennis. And the fact that she's the only tennis player ever to win 5 medals, period, I really need to see her at the White House. Like, that's a remarkable achievement. And I think Venus has been underrated. You know, Serena has gotten a lot of the shine. I'd like to see more on Venus and what she's doing.
I love what you just said, that she is the other sister. Because for those of us, and I know Reverend Merrick and Stacia, you as well, I want to bring you to the conversation. We remember when the Williams sisters came out, right? That whole notion, that's back when they used to have the click-clack beads in their braids. You know, their father was this dominating presence. That here are these girls from Compton, and I remember when they used to go against each other. And it was such a sad feeling in the air watching them go against each other and one walking away with the victory, but watching them hug and cry. But for some reason, Venus has become the other sister, though she was the one that we first were introduced to, and she was the one winning first. I mean, so Stacia, is it this whole notion that some people say that, you know, white America can't take too many black people winning at one time? Like, we have to kind of pick and choose who the victors are going to be one at a time. So it's not Simone and Gabby. It's Simone or Gabby, not Venus and Serena. It's Venus or Serena. What do you think about that?
I think historically there is a pitting against each other when it comes to black athletes competing. And I grew up watching the Williams sisters. We're around the same age. And I totally agree that Venus has become the other sister, even though she's the oldest and she's the one that we were introduced to first. I think just generally, though, we don't value the Williams sisters as much as we should.
So.
And both of them, I mean, like, as dominant as Serena has been for as long as it's been, I just don't think that she gets her due. I don't think either of them get their due. And it's just completely unfair.
Now, Reverend Merrick, we also went with Serena. And I mean, we know she left the Olympics very, very early on losing. But do we not have to deal with the backlash against what Serena looks like? I mean, we hear that often when she wins something and you just read the comments. And I often tell people, don't read the comments at the bottom if you want to have a good day. But the comments say things, from accusing her of being a man to calling her different animal species. Like, what is this backlash? And is that really at the heart of what we're talking about here?
It's the heart of, in America, what types of femininity are valued, right? And so she, just by the very much who she is completely outside of the norm of that American or European aesthetic. And so she is attacked. I remember one time somebody compared her to a horse, like, who was the best champion?
Oh, yeah.
Sports person of the year, and they wanted to put up a horse who's actually not a person. It's an entity, a living being, but clearly not a human being. It shows that America is still trapped in this thing of, like, are black people even really human? Do black lives really even matter?
Oh,
when you see what I'm saying? And the irony is that her presence on the world stage has bolstered how people look at American tennis and American sports. She's one of the most prolific ever, and still, even in her own country, she is met with a level of vitriol that is completely inappropriate for who I dare say is the queen of the court.
I mean, one of the things they said, that when she lost to the Olympics, the concern was that no one's going to watch tennis now. I mean, there's real, and they have seen it. It's kind of like when Tiger Woods lost in golf. People stop. I mean, for black folks, you stop watching golf. I'm watching golf because of Tiger. I'm watching tennis because of Venus and Serena. And unfortunately, we have to be clear that these are areas where you still see very few black people. I mean, golfs are at the Olympics now, and you still see very, very few black people here. I tell you, we're going to leave it there. What an amazing conversation we have to pick up as we get to the end of the Olympics. We have to bring you both back. Stacia Brown, freelance writer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And as always, Reverend Merrick Moise, we're just so excited to have you as a frequent guest here on our show. Thank you again.
Gracias.
Yes, visit us online at steinershow.org and take a listen to some of our podcasts. This is Dr. K. Let this be the time that you speak up and speak out. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is Wall Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's show to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And we are your source for cool jazz and more WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Dr. K. Thank you for listening.